Hey, everybody, this is Steph. I know you're not used to hearing me at the top of episodes, but I wanted to call a couple things out. The first thing is, I think this might be our best episode yet. It's certainly the episode that me and Kel are the most excited to launch. We spent 4 hours recording this episode, and the output is only 2 hours because it was extremely emotional. And even though we're partners and we've processed a lot of this together, we had to take quite a few breaks along the way. Now, you might be wondering what this episode is about. It's about finding meaning in sudden death. It's about what you can learn from perhaps the most difficult situations that you may face in your life. Now, we call this podcast The Shit You Don't Learn in School because we try to talk about topics that we don't think are covered enough. And we think this topic of death is something the world really doesn't prepare you for. And while we're not trying to offer a formula, we hope this episode is a small reminder of the fragility of life because we know how easy it is to get lost in the day-to-day shuffle and to forget what's truly most important. Throughout the episode, you're going to hear me ask Kel a lot of questions, perhaps some dumb questions, perhaps some excellent questions, but I try to ask the questions that sometimes people may be unwilling or afraid to ask, and luckily Kel was willing to share those parts of his story. Before we dive in, I did want to call out a trigger warning. If you are going through a grieving period or you're simply not ready to listen to difficult topics like suicide, mental health, or sexual abuse, we completely understand. On the other hand, if you're listening to this and you think that someone could really benefit from this episode, please share it with them. Even if you aren't grieving, you likely know someone that is and may want to support them in that process. As sad as this episode may sound, there's also a lot of joy and a lot of growth embedded within the content. And we simply believe that there's not enough raw content out there like this. So give the episode a listen. It starts a little slow, but we think by the end, you're going to love it just as much as we do. So here we have it. Finding meaning in sudden death.
Welcome back to the Shit You Don't Learn in School podcast. This is Calvin Rosser.
And this is Steph Smith.
And today we're going to be talking about finding meaning in sudden death.
Many listeners don't really get to see our behind the scenes of how we choose topics. And typically it's me or Cal coming together and saying, I find this topic really interesting, or I'm an expert here. This is one that we both were extremely excited to discuss because death is this universal human experience. We all at some point in time will die, and on our journey there, we will likely experience a lot of death around us. But what's interesting is despite this being such a universal topic, it is rarely covered in podcasts. I personally don't think I've listened to a podcast episode about this. I'm sure they're out there. But again, it's this universal experience. You know, not everyone will become an entrepreneur. Not everyone will become a productivity expert. Not everyone will become a doctor. There's podcasts out there for all of those topics. But one universal thing is that everyone will die and everyone will likely have someone close to them die. So as grim as this might sound, I think it's really interesting to have these conversations as a society, as people, as humans connecting with each other, because this is the reality of life. And the reason I was so excited to talk about this with Cal in particular is because we come from very different frames. And so really this episode will mostly be asking Cal a lot of questions because I'm very lucky to not have had anyone close to me pass away yet. On the other hand, Cal has had the unfortunate experience of losing at least 2 people very close to him, his childhood mentor and his mom a few years ago. Cal, I wanted to start this conversation off by just asking you, why did you want to have this conversation and what are you looking to get out of it?
Yeah, I loved your intro. I think death is an interesting thing in that it's this underlying current that drives a lot of our decisions and also a lot of pain and other things around us, yet we don't often talk about it. And I think, at least in my experience, when someone close to you dies or when you have a friend who maybe has someone close to them die, you don't always get the behind the scenes. And as you navigate it for the first time, it's often extremely difficult and subsequent times are difficult as well. But I think it would be useful to just, you know, talk about these experiences more openly. And I think at least for me, what I found is whether it's through writing or talking about my experiences losing people close to me, that's actually helped me in my grieving period, which is a little bit of a selfish motivation there. But at the same time, I've also noticed that for whatever reason, I'm actually able to talk about these things. And I find a lot of people who have lost people in their lives just can't talk about this stuff. So I've had this good fortune of my mind allows me to do this. And I think it's in some ways like a service to do so. So that's why I've written freely about some of the experiences I've had and am now comfortable kind of talking about it, even if it's very raw and painful and brings up things that maybe you don't want to think about all the time.
Yeah. And if people are interested in digging into this a little more, we'll call out resources throughout the episode. But if you want to start, you can go to calvinrosser.com/suicide, where Cal shares his story about his mother's death. And then also calvinrosser.com/eulogy-for-mom. So you can start there. But on that note of trauma, I think there are many traumatic events in life. Death of a close loved one is probably at the height of the various types of trauma. But one of the things I've learned about trauma over time is this need to process it, right? To not just bottle it in. And that's one of the reasons that I'm so excited to hear more from you on this topic, because I think that's something that a lot of people could benefit from, both hearing your story, but also getting in tune with their own story and not bottling that up and being able to share it in a similar way.
I think that's spot on. And I guess one of the other motivations here is I think experiencing the death of someone close to you or potentially your own encounter with death is often somewhat of an awakening experience. The things that maybe you thought were important before suddenly become very trivial. And so to the extent that I can communicate things that may help people on their journey of figuring out what's important in their life as well, I think that's another thing that I would hope people take away from this, because I think it's easy to ignore this thing that's going to happen to all of us. And it's actually more comfortable to do so. And at least in my own life, I try to remember that I may not have tomorrow, and that at least helps shape how I think about today and making sure I'm living an aligned life.
To set the roadmap for listeners, we're going to start by sharing the two stories of the two loved ones that Cal unfortunately has lost. And then from there, we're going to move into dealing with grief. How do you process that? What's helped Cal? And then I want to close out the conversation with learnings. And as pragmatic as that sounds, which sounds strange when you're talking about such an emotional topic, I think that's really important, because I think you've learned a lot throughout these two deaths. And it's been several years since both of them. And so I think where you are mentally today is a very different place than, of course, when these immediately happened. And I think maybe some people are earlier in that journey. So let's start with Howard. Who was Howard to you?
Yeah. So when I was a young lad growing up in the world, I wanted really one thing, which is to excel in academics and get to a top university. I grew up pretty poor. And for whatever reason, I had identified this goal of going to an Ivy League school as my best way to improve the quality of my life. And I was talking about this at a Thanksgiving dinner. And one of my relatives was like, oh, you want to go to Harvard? I know a Harvard interviewer. Let me give you his number. So I called this number and an old Jewish guy answered the phone. And I told him a little bit about my story and just swung it. And I was like, maybe this won't lead anywhere. And he's like, oh, well, I'm not a Harvard interviewer, but I have a son that goes to Harvard. I'm actually a therapist, but come into my office. I came into this guy's office and I'm a little bit nervous, like going to a stranger's place. But I sit there and I tell him my story for 2 hours. And for whatever reason, Howard saw some sort of potential in me. And he was like, okay, I'm going to help you do this. I want to help you get to where you want to go. So for the next 18 months, he did so many things for me in terms of helping me get into an Ivy League school. He flew me to Boston to meet with his son. He helped me write my essays. He helped show me that I had a story worth telling. And basically, he took this like package of who I was and put it into a format that these schools would appreciate, which was like a poor kid trying to make it in the world who was very contribution oriented and stuff. I ended up getting into Princeton and forming this bond with Howard outside of that achievement. And I'd say together, that was this amazing experience. And as I went through my time at Princeton, he did so many things for me. Like he taught me how to use chopsticks. He bought me my first suit. He flew me to London and Amsterdam so I wouldn't be such a Neanderthal and I could actually connect with my peers. Basically, he helped me do what I'm writing a book about right now, which is ascend in the world. He taught me how do I move from this kid who has this uncultured experience and who doesn't know much to someone who can hang with Ivy League type kids and actually start to grow and move towards something in the world.
One of the things that I think we'll probably discuss in the second story with your mom is that you also didn't have a father figure growing up. Would you say that Howard effectively was that father figure to you?
I will say that Howard definitely thought he was the father figure for me. So I think that was part of his motivation. He actually often referred to me as his third son. And I think even his two kids were like, Dad, this is a little bit weird. Like, this kid is not your actual son. But he very much thought of me that way. And he was certainly like a paternal figure. I will say that my grandfather was someone who is very important in my life and really did serve like that father figure. But Howard was almost like a second version of that, but someone who was mostly already embedded in this world that I wanted to enter. So he helped me actually become a part of something that I wanted to. And again, from his perspective, definitely I was his third son.
You formed this really deep relationship with Howard over several years. And then unfortunately, you got some bad news. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. So this was in my third year of college. And by this point, Howard had helped me travel the world multiple times. He helped me stay with an ambassador. Like, he was really pushing me through my experience at Princeton. He also even gave me a credit card and allowed me to spend some money so that I could fit in with my peers in different ways. And he was just instrumental to me making it through this experience. And I had actually just gotten some amazing news, which is I got an internship at Barclays, which was an investment bank. And this would likely lead to a job where after graduation, I would earn six figures and basically achieve this milestone of not being a poor kid anymore. And so I flew home to Florida for spring break and I met with Howard. And I think we smoked weed together, if I remember it correctly, which kind of tells you the depth of the relationship there. We became friends in our own way. And we just sat there and like we celebrated this moment, which was like a massive accomplishment for me. And a couple of days later, Howard ended up, I think he was getting hip replacement surgery. I got a call that the surgery went well. But then 12 hours later, I also got another call, which was Howard had some sort of complication and he wasn't going to make it. I really didn't process this fully at the time. I just went to the hospital and tried to figure out what was going on. It turned out that whatever had happened to him, he ended up in a coma and he basically was just not going to wake up from that. And I was never going to talk to him again. And I actually didn't talk to him after the surgery because I thought everything was going to be okay. And so it led to this moment where I talked to his family and that was a little uncomfortable because I wasn't as close with them. And I walked into his room and I just see this person who helped me so much, my mentor, a person who all he asked for everything that he gave to me was a ticket to my graduation at Princeton. And the full realization happened that not only was he not going to be a part of my story, he wasn't going to get that final gift that I could give him, which is that ticket to New Jersey to see Princeton and to watch all of his efforts culminate into something that was special for me, but also for him. And I was just looking at his body laying there and I didn't know what to say. I just broke into tears and told him how much he had done for me, hoping that maybe he could hear it in some way, shape, or form. And shortly after, I guess they removed him from life support and he died. And I guess just to wrap that experience up, when I left the room, I didn't really know what to do with his family. I was, again, like very uncomfortable with that. I just handed his son the credit card that Howard gave me. And I was like, I guess I'm going to have to go at this life on my own now. This person that I still needed was gone. And it was hard to process.
I think this story really speaks to this concept, which I know you are very in tune with, which is the fragility of life and that the people around us, we kind of subconsciously expect to be there tomorrow. And most of the time they are, but sometimes they're not. And I want to get into this a little more with the story of your mom as well. But something I want to touch on here was the surprise of this death. You didn't see this coming. It's not like he had cancer for several years. So as this being your first really intimate experience with death, and then layered on top of that, the surprise element. I'm curious to know, you know, how did you deal with that? And if you're willing to share, how did that impact perhaps the other parts of your life at that time?
Howard's death was just very devastating for me on so many levels. I think it came at actually a good time, if any, because I had achieved a milestone where I felt like I could sort of make it without him. And even practically speaking, when I took that internship that summer, I had to pay for housing and I ended up having to take out a loan because Howard wasn't there, but he had gotten me far enough to where I could get this job and where I could figure out how to do things on my own and had set the foundation for my life. So I'm really grateful that I got that amount of time with him because had it been shorter, I don't know exactly what would have happened to my trajectory. What I'll say is actually weirdly enough, when I was 11, my best friend was my dog, Pepper. And it's because my mom went through a series of boyfriends and I moved schools a lot. And all I had was this dog and she was my source of stability. Pepper had a kind of a similar fate where she developed a tumor around her aorta and they couldn't operate and she died within a few days. And in some strange way, Pepper's death kind of prepared me for Howard's death. And I wasn't totally unaware of how precious life could be, even though it was with a dog and not my mentor. But the reality is it just destroyed me in so many ways. I was in, I think, my hardest semester at Princeton. I was taking a junior seminar where I had to write this like 40-page research paper. And I was trying to interact with my peers after studying abroad and sort of changing as a person. I go back and everyone else is having such a good time and I'm just completely broken inside. The worst part was the person that I wanted to most talk about, the experience with was the person who I lost. And in some weird way, Howard gave me another novel experience that I think helped me with my mom's death as well, which was the death of someone I cared about in a really sudden way. And just, you know, practically speaking, I remember I was on a bus. We had these formal events for, I think, my girlfriend's sorority, and I was in a suit and we were on a school bus and everyone was drinking and there's music playing. And all I was doing was just bawling my eyes out in the corner of this bus, feeling like such a loser, feeling so alone and not knowing what I could do because I didn't know anyone who could really help me through that experience. And at least with my family, I always served as like the source of strength and the foundation of being the strong one. So I didn't feel necessarily that I could turn to them, even though I likely could have. And it led to a series of things. Like I thought about taking a semester off at Princeton, though I couldn't afford it. I ended up, you know, having my relationship at the time, which was one I had since the beginning of college. Like we broke up a few times. I was on edge completely. I would break down at random moments. And financially, I didn't know if I was going to be able to make it, even though I didn't have a lot of expenses. I'll just finish that with, it was an extremely turbulent time and it started to erode at pretty much every piece of my life in a way that I felt like I was moving towards a precipice. And it was a 50-50 shot whether or not I would fall off or whether I would be able to hang on and pull myself back up.
I think many people in their early stages of grieving are at this point where it feels like it'll never end, that there was life before that death and life after that death, and things will never be the same. And to a degree, it sounds like things won't quite be the same. But was there a point where things started to get better? And if so, what really did enable you to continue pushing forward and continue working towards that legacy that you initially started with Howard?
So I would say the pangs of grief certainly get easier with time. And that's probably undeniable for anyone. And I do agree there's a before the death and after the death. And certainly life was not the same. It changed my worldview in some ways. And at least for the next year, led to a lot more turbulence for me personally. I think what kept me going, I had a number of friends who were there for me in different ways. So when I was struggling with my junior paper at Princeton, I had a buddy who I was like, I'm not going to make it, man. Like, I'm not going to make it through the semester and I'm going to have to drop out. I won't graduate. And he took his weekends and sort of helped me think of the idea and finish it and move forward. And the relationship that I had that was in some ways falling apart, friends were there for me through that and they helped me see clearly and also not make too many rash decisions. And so I did use the people around me as a source of strength. It still felt incredibly isolating. I think one thing that kept me going is my trajectory at that time was so good in terms of moving towards where I wanted to go. So I was very busy. Like I had this internship at Barclays and the next step was get an offer for a full-time job. And once I did, I got like a small signing bonus that allowed me, at least financially, to be okay for my final year at Princeton. Basically seeing that I would be okay and then starting to think like, what would Howard want me to take away from this experience? And I think it is something around the fragility of life, but also to keep going. Like, what would he want? He would want me to graduate from Princeton. He would want me to keep traveling. He would want me to keep trying to find ways to help other people. And at least for him in particular, and I did the same thing with my mom, but the main idea I took away from his interaction with my life is that someone helped me, which meant that I needed, once I made it, to help other people. Even what I do now, where I do a lot of writing and this podcast as well, the idea behind it, all of it really is centered around paying forward whatever it is that I'm learning or experiencing and the privileges that I have and figuring out if I can use that to like shape other people's lives. And that all literally directly comes from Howard. And this idea of paying it forward, it's like a core value of mine that comes from him. So in some ways, I took his death and put it in my identity. And I said, I'm just going to continue the legacy that he would have wanted me to continue and the one that he imparted on my life.
I love what you spoke to in terms of legacy there, where I think I've been questioning the idea of legacy recently because for a long time I thought it meant like some company or some innovation that would live past me. But I've also come to recognize that legacy can be your relationships, even your ideas that are passed from one person to another, to another, to another. And it sounds like Howard, in particular, in your life, left a legacy with you through those interactions and through the concepts like pay it forward that really, really resonated with you, not just through his words, but his actions in showing you what that could look like in your own life.
Yeah, one thing that he really showed me that has shaped my approach to even how I share ideas as well is just how sustained attention from one person and even small amounts of money can radically transform someone's life. And so I think we all have these like grandiose ideas when we want to become thought leaders or something, where you want to accrue the followers and you want to have the impact. He showed me that impact happens at the individual person level, and you can certainly look for impact at scale. But one idea he imparted on me, he's like, look, I'm going to invest a lot in you. That means that you need to go pay it forward. And if you help 10 people and you teach them the same principles, they then go help another swath of people. And there's this beautiful butterfly effect, and you don't always know the ways in which it will manifest. But if you approach things from that perspective, you're going to have an impact. And it may not be that you're talked about in history or anything, but you're going to be able to help other people. And that has stuck with me. And again, I really think, going back to the idea of grief, one of the most helpful things for me was just really taking his ethos and saying, it's not gone. It's actually a part of me, and I'm going to go live and play it out. And that's exactly what Howard would want, and that's what he would do. So in some ways, like, he didn't die from that perspective. He continued on, if that makes sense.
It definitely makes sense. I don't mean to cut our conversation about Howard short, but I'd love to move on to the death of your mom, the most important person in your life. If people are interested in hearing more about the story, again, they can go to calvinrosser.com/suicide, where you share your mom's story and her battle with darkness around 3 years ago. At the beginning of that article, you say, Anthony Bourdain is dead. Kate Spade is dead. My mom is dead. The culprit, suicide, the darkness. And I want to dig into the story and how it played out for you, the emotions that you went through, what you've learned since. But I want to start by taking a step back. In the same way that we did with Howard, can you share a little bit about your mom and the role she played in your life?
Yeah. So my mom had me, I think, probably not planned. At age 24, she met my dad, I believe in North Carolina, and they quickly fell in love and had a baby. And without going too much into the details, my dad disappeared from my life by the time I was two. He was into drugs, gambling, other things. And I think he disappeared off to California, never to be seen again, and didn't give child support and stuff. So me and my mom kind of grew up, just me and her, and she had really bad taste in men. She really liked tattooed bad boys. And that meant, you know, people who ended up going to jail or people who didn't treat her very well. So we had a pretty turbulent time during my first 10 years of life. And she wasn't particularly financially stable. She moved around jobs a lot. I don't think she ever made more than $15,000 a year. All of that is to say is that it really was, for most of my life, like, me and my mom against the world. And I think even at a very young age, I learned that she was vulnerable in a lot of ways and that I needed to be her source of strength. And so in some ways, I became her rock, and we had a very close relationship. I think it was in large part because I was her sole meaning in her life and kind of the main source of strength. She was also the person who loved me no matter what and sort of taught me that I could go do anything. She even said, you can go to jail and I'll still love you, or you can go be a big bad businessman and I'll still love you, and just endlessly supported me. So we were just this team that was taking on what was a pretty hard world for both of us. And I think we, in some ways, endured because we did it together.
So for the first 18 years or so of your life, you and your mom were a team. You were in it together, and then you went off to university. And it sounds like that's when she started to struggle. Can you dive more into that struggle that she faced?
Yeah. So when I went off to college, we touched on this with the story with Howard, but I was trying to radically change my life, which for me meant going to a university far away from home. It actually meant kind of extricating myself from my home, where my friends weren't particularly ambitious, and potentially spending too much time there would drag down my trajectory. And so I made this sort of trade-off where I was going to go into a new land, and I was going to go figure it out, and I was going to ascend in the world. And along the way, I was going to hopefully bring my mom along for the journey, whether that meant living vicariously through me or actually giving her her dreams in different ways financially when I could do that. I think for her, she wanted me to go live my dreams. So she was fully supportive of me going to Princeton. But at the same time, she had just suffered a divorce. I had a stepdad for a while. And I think losing me in the house, I always think back to Viktor Frankl's framework, and he wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning. But it's basically that what we need in life to be happy and fulfilled is meaning. We need something outside of ourselves. So that could be your work. It could be your relationships. It can be the kid you're raising. I think for my mom, so much of her identity was wrapped up in me. She didn't have particularly close friendships. She didn't have the career that she was trying to build to the level that maybe some other people are. So when I left the house, I think that left this big vacuum for her. And what filled that space was in part the loss of her son, but also the painful memories of her past. You know, she struggled economically throughout her life. She was abused. She was bullied. She was raped. Her biological father committed suicide. And I think she was forced to confront a lot of those things as she lived alone in the empty nest. I didn't have any brothers or sisters. She didn't have a partner or husband or anything. And she was sort of just left alone. And in that aloneness, I think what I call the darkness, which is depression, anxiety, it's the, you know, pain and suffering of life. It started to fill her soul in a way where she struggled to get by. And I think she started going pretty deep into a depression.
When she started going down into that depression, what did that look like?
At this point, it's hard to recount all the details, but the short version of it is she started looking for ways to fill that hole and to fill that depression. And depression is difficult because, you know, you don't want to get out of bed, which means you don't want to go to work, which means you're not engaged with your relationships. It's this thing that can lead into a very negative cycle if you're not able to break it. My mom sought help in different ways. She went to therapists. She went to psychiatrists. She would reach out to me. She, I think, turned a lot to marijuana. And I don't believe she started drinking at that time, but she later did and was kind of looking for a way out. Unfortunately, in her story, I think early on, she probably could have recovered had she gotten the help that she needed. But I think the people that she saw psychiatrists, and they would put her on like a cocktail of medications. Those would be antidepressants. They'd be sleep medication. There'd be things that had other side effects. So she at some point started gaining weight and she started being kind of tired or numbed out to the world. As much as these things maybe helped her depression, they also were not helping her engage with the world. And I think she was never able to find a way to do that through her friendships, et cetera. Ultimately, over the course of my time at college, she ended up seeing just dozens of doctors. I think her medication got changed 25 plus times. And on many occasions, she got to these like manic states. And I think she probably ended up doing some drugs and stuff. And in Florida, there's this thing called the Baker Act, which is if you're suicidal or unstable, you can get Baker Acted, which means you're put in a psychiatric ward for some period of time until you're deemed stable. And some of her early experiences in those wards, like she got abused by staff. She was put on medications that made her really antsy and kind of go crazy. Like I remember times where she was just pacing endlessly or just sitting on the couch, just sobbing. It was very hard to understand this. Like I was very left-brained and logical. And I'm like, Mom, let's just exercise. Let's go for a walk. Let's do something. Like I felt like she was missing what she actually needed, which was a source of meaning. All of that kind of kicked off this really negative spiral where she never seemed to be able to get out of a loop for a period of time.
I resonate with that story in part with my sister, who has also dealt with her own mental health issues and this idea where the system has good intentions, but in an effort to support someone, sometimes sends them down these spirals, whether it's through medication or through not seeing the right people or just really trying so many things that people end up getting frustrated and to a degree giving up. With that said, I know in your article you spoke to this idea of trying to help her find this meaning again. For a long time, it was you. And since you left the nest, you tried to help her basically regain that meaning in her life. And I think actually for people listening, there may be some people who really resonate with this, where people wrestle with the idea that they want to be there for their parents, but also progress and balance that with living their own lives. So how did you balance that? How did you kind of wrestle with that idea?
Honestly, it was really hard because at my core, I felt like there was a trade-off I was making, which was for me to ascend in the world, my mom needed to descend. And I didn't necessarily feel like she needed to do that. I felt like we could get away around that, but that was what was happening. Just even while I was in college, she was just getting worse and worse. And that became clear. And there's just multiple conversations where I got off the phone and I'm like, is this going to be the last time I talk to my mom? Is she going to commit suicide? I would beg her not to do it. I'd say, I can't live without you. I'd try to find all these ways. And I wish I had been better trained at that time. I was just like a young kid. I didn't know how to deal with the situation. And as she went in and out of hospitals, it was hard. Like my college girlfriend met my mom in a psychiatric ward, and she was manic and she would move in and out of these places. It was hard for me to piece the story of what was happening together. I would go home and she would either be very angry and agitated or she'd be crying. And it would both upset her when I came because she would anticipate me leaving, but it also would upset her when I left because she would know that I was gone for the next period of time. And I honestly just didn't know what to do as a son. My guiding light, though, was that I knew my mom always wanted me to pursue my dream. And this so happened to be my dream, at least Howard at the time, when he was still around, he was like, you know, your mom, she's probably going to continue struggling, but you can't leave Princeton and go back home. That's not going to solve her problem. It's also going to completely destroy your whole trajectory. So you're going to sabotage both of them. And I think that was also a part of my thinking as well, which is I actually couldn't solve my mom's suffering as much as I wanted to. But there was a lot of like guilt and tension associated with that. And especially going to a school where it's not that no one else experienced struggle, but I'd say it was a pretty privileged place where a lot of people had stable two-parent homes. I really couldn't connect with my peers on this front. Not only didn't I have a dad, but I had a mom who was just rotating in and out of hospitals, and there wasn't really anyone I could turn to empathize with that experience. It was something that felt very isolating in its own way.
I think something that you mentioned earlier is also very pertinent, which is that if you are in a healthy mental state, it's very easy to want to problem solve and say, look, just do X, Y, or Z, and that'll fix the problem. But of course, mental health is such a complex beast. And of course, there's many different variations of it as well, that it's really hard on the people close to that individual, because in a way, it seems so fixable, yet in other ways, it very clearly isn't. I know one thing that you worked with your mom on is trying to drive her closer towards a new source of meaning. And you did a couple exercises with her, in fact, on this. So why don't you speak through some of that effort and where that took you and your mom, and whether you think it could be successful elsewhere?
After I graduated from school, my mom was still struggling. She did go through periods where she felt okay. She would do electric shock therapy, which kind of zapped her memory. We don't have to go into the details there, but there's another negative spiral when you get treatment where if your brain isn't functioning that well after you get the treatment, then you can't kind of memorize things for your jobs. And she struggled to reintegrate in various ways. But one of the things that happened for me is I started reading pretty voraciously, I think around 24. And one of the books I stumbled across was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning, which I referenced earlier. The thesis of that was just that we all need a source of meaning. When I was reading this book, a lot of things clicked for me. And one of them was that I felt like all of the help that my mom had received so far, whether it was medications or therapy that focused on her past traumas, was all geared towards, you know, talking about what was wrong in her life and how she could develop a better relationship with that, or numbing her out or changing her dopamine receptors and stuff. I certainly think there's a role for pharmacological solutions in mental health. What I will say is what I felt like was missing is no one gave my mom something to look forward to. What was the life that she was going to create? And I think that was the thing that I was like, if I can help her create this life where she has flourishing relationships, this life where she has a career that she's really excited about, this life where she has maybe a romantic relationship that is very healthy. I just, in my mind, I'm like, if I can help my mom with this, I think some of the past traumas and other things will lose their weight on her mind because she will have something to look forward to. This actually happened one Christmas Eve, which was kind of a shitty way to spend that time. But she was in a psychiatric ward. She had had a complete breakdown. And I went and visited her and I took my dog and I surprised her. And she was just so excited that I was there. Mind you, these places are horrible to spend Christmas. They're like whitewashed. They have you all in the same suit. Like the people are pretty cold. You're on these medicine schedules. It really is not a pleasant place to be. So I sat down in this like completely blank room with my mom. They take away everything. There's no pens or whatever because they think you might harm yourself. I got the nurses to give me a pen and a piece of paper. And I said, hey, mom, let's go through an exercise. I know you're really suffering right now, but let's talk about what your life could be. And we sat there for the next 2 hours and we wrote down what I call like her map for meaning, which was what was she going to do to improve like her health and get in the physical shape that she wanted? What was she going to do with the relationships, her job? Like, what was she going to do to reintegrate in society in the way that she hadn't been able to? And along the way, I encouraged her, I'm like, you can do this. Like, all this is doable. It wasn't some pipe dream. It was the first time in 5 years where I saw my mom's, like, the gears in her head, they started turning in a way that I hadn't seen before. She was like genuinely excited. Like, the light was back in her eyes, and she was getting to do this with her son. We had come up with this plan, and it was on a piece of paper, and I still have it. It honestly seemed like, to me, like the last shot we had at building something for her and for the next 9 months or so before she passed. Like, she was pursuing that map for meaning. She was going through the list. She was doing the thing. She was giving me updates on this. And it was, I think, if we had done it sooner, potentially something that could have changed her path in some ways. But at least I saw what it could do to, you know, change her mind from everything is completely awful and this world is horrible, I don't want to live in it, to what if I could create something for myself where I would want to live in it? And when I left the hospital that night, I had more hope than I've had at any other point in the last 5 years for my mom's recovery. I ended up going to a Red Lobster and sitting by myself on Christmas Eve, and I had a glass of wine and ate whatever crappy food that they had there. And despite being so alone, and I was like an hour and a half from home, I felt some hope.
I really want to underscore something that you said, and I'm obviously not a professional, and this is just my interpretation, but this idea of not focusing on the past and giving someone hope for the future. And in doing so, one of the things that I think is very important is treating someone as though they can achieve that future. What I mean by this is, even you mentioned her being in that psych ward where they don't even let pens in the room because they're afraid that someone might injure themselves. I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but there's a degree of when you treat someone as though they are a patient, as though they are going to harm themselves, as though they are a debt to society, they will start to believe that themselves. I do understand why some of these things exist, but I've seen it with someone close to me as well, where when you just start treating someone as a patient, it's really hard for them to break out of that mindset because everything around them is training them to think like, my life is so messed up and like, I can't see that path forward to almost like a normal reality.
I mean, I completely agree with you. What's really tricky is, you know, some people, when they're in this psychotic state, like they really can't function and they are potential harm to themselves and others. So there's this balance of, if someone's gone too far, they probably do need to be in a place like this. Do I think, based on what I saw, could you treat people better at the very least? Sure. But, you know, at the end of the day, like if you can catch someone before they've gone too deep down the depression spiral or before they've lost themselves to drugs and alcohol, and you can create this map of meaning, I believe that at least for some percentage of people, this would help. Just to quickly harp on how bad the experience was in these wards, I think what later happened with my mom, where she took her own life, her main commitment after leaving this one institution that I visited her at was to never visit one again. The experiences she had were so bad in these places that she's like, I'm never ending up in one of these places again. And at least I'm just theorizing here, but I think when she got to the place where she knew she was going to end up in one again, she said, hell no, like, I won't do it.
Let's speak to that part of the story. Can you share what happened next for those listening?
Yeah. So over the next 9 months, using her map for meaning, my mom tried to create it. She got a job at the Waffle House, which for those listening, it may not be your ideal job, but like she tried and she was trying to reintegrate into society. And she faced a few roadblocks along the way. Like she struggled to form relationships. I think one thing when you're depressed, sometimes people don't want to be around you because they can't handle your emotional ups and downs and stuff. So I felt like she struggled to get the relationship she wanted, but she kept trying. She went to groups. That job, she ended up not being able to keep because she couldn't remember all of the orders and stuff because electroshock therapy had really killed her short-term memory. And there were just a number of like roadblocks that she had on her path to living that map for meaning. That said, she was like fighting every day. And in some ways, she was getting a lot better. Actually, on November 27th, which was the second to last text I received with her, she said, "Hi, Cal. I just wanted to let you know I've been doing good. I bought some lavender oil that you can rub on your fingers and then below your nose for a calming effect. I also put a drop in my tea. It's helping with my anxiety. I went to the YMCA today and walked 2.2 miles on the treadmill, which helped greatly with my anxiety. I think I'm going to work out in the AM in the afternoon. I'm committed to helping myself however I can. You've always been a great inspiration in my life, and I'm truly blessed to have you. I hope all is well with you. I love you with all my heart and soul." When I received that message, I'm like, wow, it's only been, it had at that point been almost a year since I had seen my mom and created this meeting. I'm like, she's doing it. She is on the path to recovery. I actually got really sick on that day that she sent that to me, and I was bedridden in Bali at the time. I was spending most of the year just traveling around the world, but supporting my mom from afar and, you know, engaging almost like as her coach via text and calls and stuff. And then I woke up on the morning of December 1st to a message from my mom that said, I love you with all my heart and soul. And a few minutes after that, I actually got a call from my grandma, and she said that my mom had consumed a lethal dose of one of the prescriptions that she had, and she was in the hospital. Her heart had stopped a few times, and she probably wasn't going to make it.
That sounds like one of the worst calls anyone could receive. And I actually can't even fathom receiving that, although, of course, it's in the realm of possibility in my life. How did you react to that call? What did you say? How did you feel after you hung up? What did you do?
Well, I can confirm your intuition that receiving a call like that is certainly an unpleasant experience. It was the first call I had in the morning. I was just waking up, and I think some part of that is just shock and processing. Another piece was, at least for me, I had expected this call for 5 years. And all those times my mom had moved in and out of the hospital, I didn't know if one day she would take her own life. I tried in many cases to stop her from doing that. And maybe I did have some success there. I'm not sure. But I think from there, I was like, wow, okay, I knew that this might happen. It's happening now. Why is it happening now? Am I ever going to see my mom again? Am I a bad person for being in Bali and not at home with her? Like, could I have stopped this? You just have this cascading set of thoughts that sends you into a mental terror with yourself. At least what I did is I hopped on my motorbike, my scooter in Bali, and I drove to the ocean, which was my mom's favorite place. And I was like, what can I do to like calm myself or my mind right now? And I just watched the waves, and you know, I started like tearing up, and it's early in the morning, so really not many people are around. And I'm like in this beautiful place, but feeling horrible on the inside. And just in that moment, I'm like, holy shit, I'm going to have to face the world without my mom. And it came in this like broader context where a few weeks earlier, I actually had quit my job to dedicate myself to finding ways to help people live a more fulfilling life. Like I was going out and I was, you know, supposed to be a source of light for people and to figure out how to carve my own like entrepreneurial path. And I was going to not have income and stuff. Life was really good for me at that moment until it wasn't.
You mentioned this feeling of shock. If I imagine getting this same phone call about my parents, I think it would just not feel real. It would just feel like this dream, this terrible dream that I would wake up from. And then of course, I wouldn't wake up from it, but I'm just curious to know how that wave of emotions happened for you. Like, was it an immediate reality for you, or did it take some time for you to really process what you had heard?
I think the difficult part of the situation I faced was she wasn't dead yet, and there was some degree of uncertainty. But at least what I knew at the time, she was in the hospital. They were cooling her body so that they would minimize the chance of brain damage or something like that. And then over the next 36 hours, if she made it, they would warm her body up gradually. So it wasn't, you know, some people, when someone commits suicide, they shoot themselves in the head and they're gone. And then there's the aftermath. In this case, there was the 30 days before she actually passed away. And at least for some part of that, I was just dealing with this uncertainty. So some of it was, okay, this is real. It definitely felt real. What can I do about it? It didn't feel like I could do much about it. Do I need to fly home right away? I decided not to do that. Actually, I don't even know that I could have at the time. Bali had this volcano that was going off for the first time in like 50 years. And I think there was limited flights in and out. So I was like, okay, just sit down, be patient, try to figure things out. My default was I just went to a place and I started reading. And I started reading The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday, which is like a book full of stoic wisdom. And I'm like, how can I find some sort of stillness in this moment while I process what's happening? I think to your point on shock and the realness of things, certainly from thousands of miles away, it was less real than when I actually visited my mom and saw it. And so from one perspective, I actually benefited from hearing the news and having time to process it before actually seeing what had happened and just being in the midst of some of the chaos. And then on another level, I had some sense of hope, like she wasn't gone yet. So maybe there was something that could be done. And on a third thing, as I mentioned, I almost had expected this call for many years, and I had cried on many nights thinking about this before. It wasn't the first time I had lived this experience, and it's because I had projected this experience many times in my past. So it almost felt like I was playing it over again, except this time it was real, and that, you know, really sucks.
As you mentioned, there was a 30-day period between receiving this call and the unfortunate day that she passed. Let's fill in some of those gaps. So you hear this news, you go somewhere and you read for a while. When did you eventually fly back and what happened after that?
As I mentioned, they were warming up her body to try to preserve the functioning and see if there was any life left in my mom. And that process actually went really well and she showed some signs of recovery. Her body was still completely destroyed. Her lungs weren't functioning. Her bowels were not functioning well. She needed a ventilator to survive, but there was some semblance of hope. And I decided to just get on a plane and head home and be there for that moment. And what happened next was both extremely shocking and sort of a blessing. But when I arrived home, I immediately went to the hospital. And as I went into my mom's room, and to my knowledge, she had not been responsive until that point. When I entered the room, she opened her eyes and she lifted herself from the bed. She was connected to all of these like tubes. It was a horrifying experience to see your mom in. And she looked at me and gave me like a big embrace, a hug. And literally the nurses around us were crying because she defied gravity. She woke up for the first time, like when her son, me, was there, and they didn't even know if she would ever be conscious again. And it was this like surreal moment where I got to hug and be with my mom. And I was told that that was not possible.
That's really special. And I feel like I'm getting emotional just hearing you talk about it. But what happened next after that moment?
So I can only call it in some ways a gift in that I got to spend some time with my mom as I knew her. You know, the first thing is after hugging my mom, I took a step back and I saw just how bad her condition was and just how beat up she looked. And I just broke into tears. And I watched her face as I did, and you could see that she was just coming to and figuring out that her attempted suicide had not worked as she had planned. I think there was a lot of fear in her eyes, but there was also a lot of pain just seeing me cry, because for the most part, my mom never really saw me cry because I was her source of strength. And so I refused to do so. And I would, you know, set goals every year where I didn't cry. And if she was feeling down, I would find some strength, even if I was struggling. And I think this was a moment where she saw me breaking down as like a young man. And all we could do is talk through our eyes. And I kind of turned to my old habits there. And I said, get yourself together, man. Your mom is awake. Some sort of miracle is happening. How can you make the most of this experience? Make her laugh. Do something fun. So I pulled out my phone and I was like, hey mom, I just came back from Bali, from Thailand, this trip to Asia. And I did all these like cool things for you. And I showed her all these experiences that I did with her in mind. Like I showed her a monkey on my back with a banana, and she loved monkeys. She would just giggle endlessly when it came to the idea of thinking about being near a monkey. I went through and I showed her all these experiences. And what was so odd was she was 100% there. She was like fully conscious, locked eyes. She couldn't breathe. She couldn't speak, but she was there appreciating this moment. And I think she knew it was a gift as well, despite probably all the fear and pain that she felt at that moment. So for the next few hours, I got to do that with my mom. I gave her a little elephant that reminded me of her. It had like pink flowers and lots of colors. She had tons of tattoos and always wore extremely colorful clothing. We had this moment and I was there with my family as well, but I don't remember actually a lot of my interactions with other people because it was just such a bizarre thing to come in thinking that your mom's going to be unconscious, but to actually live a moment with her. But at the same time, I talked to the doctors and she could die at any moment. Her body was completely failing. It was just impossible to reconcile the way that she was with me in that moment with the fact that her body could give out at any moment. That was just one of the hardest things to understand.
I remember being in contact with you during that period. And from the outside, I could sense that confusion where one day it seemed like nothing looked good. Her chances of survival were almost zero. And then another day it was like, oh, you know, there might actually be hope here. And not just there might be hope, but things are actually looking up. It seemed like from the outside, those chances were fluctuating throughout time. And it was a very confusing time throughout those weeks, trying to wrestle with this like very devastating event, but also having hope of what might happen.
Yeah, you're spot on. And that was part of the torture of this situation. So I think a lot of people, as I mentioned, with suicide, it happens instantaneously and you don't feel this closure because you can't say goodbye. For me, I had a chance to say goodbye, but at the same time, I had to deal with this hope that my mom could make it, also knowing that she may die at any moment. And just to kind of walk through how it ended up playing out is she was there with me that one night and she remained like pretty conscious, although not in great condition for some more days where I was there. And at some point the doctors were like, hey, you know, her condition is improving, but she's very fragile. And actually you being here is so activating that it's sending her body into overdrive. So you need to kind of limit your time here. And I did that for a number of days where we were waiting for her body to heal. The real milestone was like, could we remove her from the ventilator if her lungs started to recover and become less stiff? And if she could start breathing on her own, she may be able to actually make it. And it was still unclear, does she have brain damage? Does she have other types of damage? Will her bowels ever function again? I'm not a doctor, and it was hard to even understand what was going on, but there certainly was some hope. Unfortunately, she just started declining to the point where they actually couldn't take the ventilator out. I think it was somewhat of a cover your ass situation, but they decided not to do that procedure. And from there, it became a situation of just keeping her alive, and we weren't seeing a lot of signs of recovery.
That ultimately led you to what might be the hardest decision of anyone's life, which was deciding whether or not to keep her on life support. How did you navigate that decision, and what decision did you ultimately come to?
It had been a couple of weeks since she was in the emergency room and she was just being kept alive. And again, it was kind of like a daily check-in. Did she make it through the night? And I was talking to the doctors a lot during this period. Actually, my grandma, who was my mom's main caretaker, she ended up in the hospital herself at risk of dying because of the stress of the situation. She actually wasn't able to breathe. She has COPD, which really impedes the functioning of your breathing and ability to get oxygen. And at that point, the doctors were starting to suggest, you know, she's not improving at the rate that we would expect. And at some point, my family was like, well, you need to make a decision here about whether or not to keep her on life support. And we're here to support you, but it's your decision. I don't fault anyone in my family for this, but it was, you know, a wild situation where it was kind of like, it's on you. You need to decide, like, does mom stay on life support or not? I spent some time talking to a few different doctors. There's one who was like very compassionate and kind of in touch with the human side of the situation, and another who was a lot more left-brained. And what I was trying to do was like, I'm going to get a little logical here, but you know, when you're making this decision, I'm like, what's the right ethical thing to do? What's the right thing for my mom? Like, what is the situation? And so I was trying to understand, where are we at? And the basic thing that I got to, especially after talking to one of the doctors, I'm like, what would you do if this was your mom? And he said, my mom's passed, but I have a sister that I'm close with. If my sister was in this condition, I would take her off of life support. The best case for your mom is that if she recovers and gets off of this, she's in a nursing home for the rest of her life. She may have damage. Her bowels are not going to function. She's not going to live a good life. And you and your family are going to have to take care of her throughout that whole time. And as he talked through that, I talked to friends. I may have talked to you. I tried to use sounding boards of, you know, I have a compassionate friend. I have a logical friend. I have someone who knew my mom. I have someone who's removed from the situation. I tried to just take in all of the different perspectives. But at the end of the day, I sat down and I thought, what is best for my mom? And what became really clear to me, even though I don't know if it was best for me because selfishly I wanted her to live, is that she didn't want to live in this world as a perfectly functioning person. And it was too painful for her in that context. So the idea that she would have to live potentially another few decades, even if she did survive, or that she would have to endure another week of pain if she wasn't going to make it, that to me seemed really at odds with what my mom had wanted. And I think her decision to commit suicide, whether that was made in a fully rational brain or not, was a pretty clear example that she wanted to exit this world and be at peace, a peace that she never found in the world, even though I would have loved her to have found it. Taking all that in, I basically thought that the most compassionate response and best thing for my mom was that we would remove her from life support and allow her to have the ending that she was looking for.
I think that's the type of decision that's really easy to judge from the outside, but of course is so difficult to make when you are in that role. And one of the reasons that I wanted to have this discussion with you is because compared to most people, I find that you are very, very open about these topics. I think a lot of people wouldn't even want to share on a podcast that they took their mom off life support. And you're willing to answer questions that I think a lot of people believe are taboo, and they are to some degree. And I want to mirror that by asking you some of these questions, one of them being whether you have any regrets about that since, about that particular decision to take your mom off life support.
I'm happy to talk about this stuff because there is, as you mentioned, no right or wrong here. And this is like the messy stuff of adulthood that I never wanted to find myself in this situation. I never wanted to make this decision, but yet life put this in front of me. And there was no textbook, I guess, like maybe a philosophy course helped me think through the ethical nature of some of these things. But there's nothing that really I could do other than think about what is the best decision for my mom. And to do that, I had to remove myself from my own kind of selfish impulses of the situation, which honestly, at this time, I was worried that my grandma was going to fight me on this. I thought she was going to say, no, we need to keep her alive. She was going to hang on. And it was going to be this battle between us. And thankfully, she sort of listened and agreed. And as hard for her as it was, she had to let go as well. This was her daughter. And so it, you know, you're also dealing with family dynamics as much as people put it on me. Before I talk about any regrets or anything, I'd love to just finish up with how everything went from there, and then we can debrief a bit.
Let's do it.
So when we removed her from life support, it was actually kind of a strangely formal process where I had to talk to the doctor and he's like, are you sure that we want to do this? And I think I had to sign some paperwork as well. So we signed the paperwork. I'm trying to be held together during this moment. I'm trying to make the best decision for my mom and to be strong for her at least one last time. And then the doctors, they go in the room, they remove the ventilator in this case and some of the plugs, and they kind of talk about what's going to happen next. And this is one of the hardest parts of this whole experience. And it's that she, after we removed her from the ventilator, could have survived for an hour or many weeks or potentially months. And so again, like this like uncertainty in this situation is sending a dagger in me. And eventually when the doctors had removed everything, they said we could go back into the room. And it was a very bizarre experience in that when I walked into the room this time, they had lit some candles and prepared the room in this like really nice way. They were almost like preparing my mom to, you know, go into the afterlife and not to just survive in this cold hospital room. And they had pictures and other things. And it was very morbid, but also welcoming in this interesting way. And I looked at my mom and she looked at peace and very angelic without all of these contraptions keeping her alive. And the really bizarre part of it was that her eyes were open. She was not conscious. To be honest, like it was very unsettling to see her like that. But at the same time, it in some ways solidified the decision to remove her from life support because she actually looked at peace. And that's honestly all I really wanted for her for most of her life. And I felt like we were kind of moving towards that outcome and prepared myself to just be there until that would happen. Just going through the rest of the story rather quickly, what was odd is I was paying attention to a lot of the metrics. You know, how much air was my mom getting? When her lung capacity was increasing, I was like, is she going to make it? I still had this like almost a sense of hope. Maybe this is some form of denial. I don't know. But I went to one of the nurses and I kept asking about the metrics. And she's like, you know, my dad went through the situation not too long ago. And all I can say is my best piece of advice for you is don't worry about what the charts are saying. Don't worry about the beeping. This is likely going to come to an end. And this is likely going to be the last time you spend with your mom. So be there for it. And don't worry about the metrics. It ended up being really good advice because I just settled down next to my mom. I held her hand. and I said nice things. I was like, you were the best mom. You were supportive. You got me where I am today. And, you know, all the things that you might want to say to a person, I don't know if she could hear me or not. In some sense, like I thought she could. And so I said them. And I really just sat by her bed for the next 48 hours. And my job was kind of pay attention to when she's in pain. So her body might convulse or she may look agitated. And when she was in pain, I kind of had the quasi-authority to say, hey, nurses, give her some more morphine. And morphine is interesting in that the more you give to someone, the less their body's going to function. And so in some ways, it may accelerate what's happening. And I just made sure for 48 hours that I held my mom's hand. I told her kind things and I gave her morphine, or the doctors did, when she needed it, so that at the very least, she wasn't in pain. At some point, about 48 hours after we had removed her from life support, the doctors thought she might survive for a while and they were going to move her to another facility. And so we were planning for that to happen. And about an hour before it did, the nurses called me to a room and I'm dreary-eyed. I'm like barely functioning at this point. And I hear them start to sing a song, which was Happy Birthday. It was my birthday. And they gave me a carrot cake, which is my favorite cake. It was a nice gesture, but I'm like giving a half smile because there's some serious shit going on. And as much as I appreciated it, it didn't really feel like, you know, the birthday that I might have wished that I had. And around that time, my mom's metrics, as you may call them, really started declining. Like her breath started to slow. The time between them did. And this was a signal that her body was sort of rapidly deteriorating and that the end might be near. So the doctors made the call not to move her to another facility, which I'm kind of grateful for because, you know, it would have prolonged this whole thing. And some of that uncertainty that I had was starting to fade. And I was realizing these were potentially her last moments. There was about an hour before she passed where we kept seeing her breath slow and such. And at some point, like this tsunami of emotion just boiled within me. And I literally couldn't even hold my head up. I was sobbing like from the depths of my soul. I felt like it was being like just shred into 1,000 pieces. And my family is trying to comfort me and I can't even move. I'm in so much pain and I don't know what to do. And eventually I pull myself out of that and we maybe have like 15 minutes to go. And I just sit by my mom's bed and I go back to being strong for her in that one last moment and holding her hand and just committing to being there with her. And at some point, her breath slowed to maybe 8 seconds between them, 10. And this is perhaps the final gift she gave me. But as she took her last breath, she opened her eyes and she fluttered them and she looked at me and then she was gone. And from that moment, my family, they gathered around my mom. We all said, I think, kind words. We went in a circle. These are, if you've ever been in this situation, it's a very bizarre experience. It's like quasi-religious in nature. And then most of my family left and it was just me and my grandma. And we just looked at each other and we hugged and we cried. And my grandma said goodbye. And then I was left in the room alone with my mom. And I'm just thinking in my head, you know, she's gone. What do you do? In some ways, it's like really hard to look because she's gone. But at the same time, I want to have some sort of closure. And so I said my, you know, final nice words. I gave her a kiss on the forehead. And I told her that I loved her and that I would make her proud. And I walked away and I took one last look. And that was the last time I saw her.
Thank you for sharing that. I'm also getting emotional just hearing the story, and I'm sure people in the audience are as well. One of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast episode is because, as we talked about, you don't often hear people talk about this subject, but also you don't tend to get to share this kind of emotion on podcasts. And so thank you for sharing that emotion with me, but also with the listeners. I'm sure many other people who have gone through this or are anticipating a loss like this will really resonate with that emotion, which again, you don't typically hear on these mediums.
I appreciate that. I am open to sharing this because this is life. And even the theme of this podcast, like the things you don't learn in school, I certainly didn't learn how to deal with this situation. And I don't know that anything could have prepared me for it, but all of us face things like this in one way, shape, or form. And you have to learn how to confront that and also move forward. And just to wrap up on what you asked that led us down that journey was around any regrets around this decision of choosing to have my mom be removed from life support. And, you know, to be honest, at least for me, I truly at the time and still do believe that was the best decision for her. And one of the things that kind of confirmed that for me was when she passed, as much as I felt like I had lost this really important person and piece of me, I simultaneously felt this relief. And it was relief that my mom could finally be at peace, the peace that she never found in this world. And in some ways, that decision that I had to make, or that eventually would have to be made, I think that led to her to experience peace. And I don't know where she went or what the afterlife has in store for us, but I do know that she's no longer suffering here. And that's ultimately what she wanted.
Thank you for being so open about that. I have a ton of questions, mostly that come from a selfish place, again, as someone who hasn't experienced this before, but about grieving, about how things evolve over time, about how other people can support you. So what I wanted to start out with was this idea that death alone is such a huge emotional weight on the people around that death. But on top of that, something that you've shared with me is the additional responsibility that comes with death. When you truly just want to be processing this, to be doing absolutely nothing, there's actually a lot of other things that end up on your plate, whether it's planning for a funeral, whether it's dealing with lawyers or emptying storage. Can you speak a little more about this and what you went through post-death?
So I think actually one of the least talked about things as it relates to when you lose someone are the logistics of what happens next. If this just happens to a friend, you're likely not going to have to deal with it. But if it's a family member, there's a host of things you need to do at a time when you're most unable to do anything. And so planning a funeral means inviting people, means going to a funeral home and such. Thankfully, my family really helped me with that piece of it. I was supposed to write a eulogy for my mom, and I'm barely able to open my eyes. I'm so exhausted. And just processing this thing, and I'm supposed to somehow capture a speech that I give to other people that captures her like life or my relationship with her, that felt insurmountable at the time. And there was other things, like we had to go through a probate process, which meant talking to lawyers who, you know, certainly don't really understand your situation, and dealing with the logistics of that. And then at the same time, you also have to do this weird thing of being able to respond to other people. So all of my friends who knew my mom died, when people watch someone die from the outside, they want to know, like, how are you? They're asking you questions, and you have to answer those questions. And you may just want to shut off and be like, I just want to go inward for a bit. You also have this responsibility of dealing with other people's like anxiety and wanting to know about your situation. They're doing it from a compassionate angle, so you can't fault them. But all of this is extremely overwhelming at a time when you're like, I need a breather. For me, this 30 days of her being alive was just one of the most intense periods that I've gone through with anything. And so it was particularly acute to deal with all the other things involved with my mom passing.
Yeah, that's something that I just hadn't thought through before hearing that as a part of your story, where you think through the emotional burden and not the logistical burden that comes after. Not to say the logistical burden is even comparable, but just that that is something that you have to balance in tandem. The emotional burden, on the other hand, is something that lasts a lot longer. And I want to speak to the grief that you experienced. But before we do that, I've heard you speak about the loss of your mom akin to losing an invisible parachute. Can you explain what this means to you?
Yeah, so this actually comes from a show that I really enjoy because it gives you insight into an era that was seemingly very different from ours. But the show is Mad Men, and there's this wealthy trust fund boy who runs the thing, and he's not a boy, he's an old man, but his name is Roger Sterling, and he loses his mom. What he says is just so beautiful and really resonated with my experience. He said, you know, I used to jump off mountains, and it never occurred to me that I had this invisible parachute. My mother loved me in some completely pointless way. And it's gone. So there it is, She gave me my last new experience. And now I know that all I'm going to do from here on out is lose everything. And why that resonates so much with me is I felt very similarly that throughout my life, I did all of these things. I experimented. I tried to ascend in the world. And a lot of it was on the backbone of my mom's, as Roger Sterling puts it, completely pointless belief and love in me. She really did just love me in this way that was unfettered and that was not tied to any specific outcomes. And it was one of the biggest gifts she gave me, where she just kind of believed in everything I did. And so when I made mistakes in my life, I got arrested at 14, I got into fights, I ended up almost going down the wrong path in many cases. I was able to recover from that and also continue to like do new things in the world and really push myself to new limits. Limits where, looking at where I am at today, I would have never guessed I had made it this far in that short of time. And I think a lot of it came from this invisible parachute that she had. And now when I think about doing things, I actually think in some ways my resilience or my ability to, you know, feel like things are going to be okay, that's gone because my parachute isn't quite there in the same way.
I've heard you and others speak about death in this before and after way. And it sounds like this death has really fundamentally changed your worldview and the way that you encounter life since that death. But at the same time, I've also witnessed your grief evolve throughout time. And where you are today, at least versus 3 years ago, does seem like a different place. And so perhaps for other people grieving, can you share a little bit more about how that grief evolved and maybe some of the ways that you were able to process and overcome some of that grief?
So I think people are familiar. There's like 5 stages of grief. I don't know what they are, but I think it's probably a roughly accurate model of what happens when someone dies. I think what's not as much talked about is while you may go through each of those phases, the time at which you spend in each phase and what that actually looks like for you in your life is very personal and different. So for me, in this case, my mom died on my 25th birthday and also my last day at a job before I went and tried to create my own like entrepreneurial path. And so there was a lot of change happening all at once. And during that initial period of grief, I was trying to deal with the logistics of my mom's death. I was trying to process that she was gone. And at the same time, I was trying to build something from scratch. And all of that eventually over many months kind of wore on me and ended up sinking me in some ways. But at least just to walk you specifically through some things that have happened, in the first 2 months, I don't know if it would be considered clinical PTSD, but I would lay down at night and I would have just racing visuals of like watching my mom die and watching her suffer. The same thing would happen when I woke up in the morning. It was like these flashbacks of what was happening and it stopped me from getting good sleep. It made me restless. It made me anxious in a lot of different ways. At the same time, I had what I think of as like this kind of like emotional volcano within me, and it would erupt at random times. I'd be sitting at lunch with like people I had just met, and all of a sudden I have this like surge of emotion going through me. And I thought of all of this as just like, well, shit, I just need to deal with this. I need to find ways to do it. And so things that I would do to help through that process, which was totally random and very disruptive to day-to-day life, I would swim laps really aggressively. Whenever I felt like a ball of emotion, I would run. In fact, I would sprint on the beach and I would sprint until I couldn't breathe and the emotion had somewhat subsided. I also, for a period of time, didn't drink. And my thesis, which I think is true, was I think the fastest way to overcome grief is to be present with it. And what that means is I didn't want to numb myself out to these experiences I was having. How was I ever going to move on from these like racing things in my head morning and night? I didn't know when they were going to end, but I did know that I wanted to feel them because if I didn't feel them, maybe they would last for longer. So I think things like alcohol and drugs, like I mostly stayed away from that stuff because I felt like it would slow me down while at the same time certainly not help me. In the first few months, I would say one thing that I regret a little bit was not being more compassionate with myself. At least in my like professional life, I was trying to push on. I was trying to build something from scratch. I was taking on a lot of things. And I think what I really needed to do was to just take a break. And I actually had the opportunity to do that at the time and just be a lot more compassionate with myself and understanding of like my irritation and my shortness with others. It wasn't their fault. Like when I was still with my family, I lashed out at my grandma a few times. I was very angry. just to wrap that up, there was a lot of physical manifestations of my grief that impacted my relationships, my ability to focus, my sleep, everything. It just came into my life. And if you're dealing with this and trying to also be a good person at work or be a good partner, some of those things are at conflict with this thing that you're processing. And so my advice for my future self when I deal with this and for anyone else is to try to be compassionate with yourself. Give yourself as much space as possible. Leave the calendar clear. Don't just busy yourself and feel those emotions. And that in many ways was able, I think in those first few months, to allow me to at least feel what I was feeling. And as I started to feel it, it started moving throughout my body instead of solidifying. Now we're getting into something that I don't know how it works, but instead of maybe like calcifying somewhere and sticking there and being this heaviness on me. But for months, I had what felt like a hurricane just brewing inside that could erupt at any moment.
One of the other things you've written about during this period of grieving was unpacking her storage unit. The article, if people are interested in reading, is called Unpacking Unit 73, Insights from Revisiting My Youth. And they can find it at calvinroster.com/unpacking-unit-73. In the article, people can find anything from goal setting in the eighth grade to childhood pictures to the first love letters that you sent when you were younger. So it's a really enjoyable read, but what you had to do here was go through this storage unit and relive many aspects of your youth, many of which were shared with your mom. From talking to you and through reading this article, it does seem like this was really painful, but also really important in your grieving process and moving through that. So can you speak a little bit more to that?
Yeah. So that article is certainly one of the most embarrassing ones that I've ever written because it highlights so many of my flaws. But what happened was after my mom had passed, she had a storage unit and it had most of her stuff and it had most of my stuff from my childhood as well. She was living with my grandparents at the time and they had just packed up my childhood home and put it in this storage unit. One day me and my uncle went there and this was shortly after she passed and we had to like cut the lock and it was pretty sketchy. Like we didn't have the code or anything. But once we got it open, there was, I think there were many dozens of boxes. And so I went through this process over the course of 4 days where I looked in every single box and it was everything from my childhood yearbooks to love letters to all this stuff that my mom had, like her clothes, her angels, her possessions, everything that she owned and everything that represented my childhood as well, which at this point I had graduated from Princeton and spent a few years working. And I really had distanced myself from my childhood because I kind of had to do that to move where I was. And I was hitting the point in my life where I started thinking back to home. And this really actually in some ways brought me back to home. But I spent the next 4 days going through each one of these boxes and pretty much deciding, do I keep something? Do I throw it away? Or do I donate it? And practically speaking, what this meant is that I threw away or donated like most of the stuff that represented my childhood and my mom's life. And my grandma was sitting there the whole time being like, no, we need to keep this. We need to keep that. But practically speaking, we would have had to buy another house and that was not a viable option. And as I went through this stuff, I basically relived who I was up until that point and also my relationship with my mom. I saw all the gifts I gave her as I went through item by item. This is the thing that I think helped with my grief. I looked at my trophies from golfing. I looked at my love letters. I looked at the things my mom had given me, cards, whatever. And I took them in. I sometimes took pictures of them and I wrote that little article about some of the funnier things I found. But after that, after accepting those things and processing them, I got rid of most of the stuff. And in doing so, I was kind of forced to confront like everything I had been or done up until that point in my life and to remember lots of things. And I think in many ways that actually helped me because I connected with things and I found my mom's old journals, which I'm now using to understand her life and to partially write a book about. And there's lots of gems within that. But as much as it was like a useful exercise and produced a funny article, it was a horrible thing as well to, at that moment, relive everything over and over. But in reliving it, in some ways, I was able to accept it and let it go. Whereas I've seen other people, they hold on. And in this process, let me let go. One thing that was really horrible from that whole experience was I found a police report that my mom had filed. And in that police report, I basically read that at some point during my years in college, she had been raped by someone who I had actually met at one point and I got horrible feelings from. To read in detail something like that, I think for about anyone is horrible, but to hear in detail that your mom was raped and to have the account of that, that was something that put some of her story into perspective for me in a lot of ways, where she was suffering and she didn't get the right solutions from doctors and such. But she also had just these things happen to her that, of course, happened to other people. But it was this cascading effect of just really bad stuff at the wrong time. And, you know, it helped me understand a little bit more about how she ended up at the outcome that she did. And the same thing was true of reading some of her journals, where I saw how hard she was fighting. I saw her pain. And in confronting those things, I'm breaking down in tears for most of it. But at the same time, I'm also understanding, like, how did my mom come to the point where she decided to leave me? Because that's what it feels like.
One of the questions I wanted to ask was around this idea of suicide and whether knowing that your mom actively chose to kill herself impacts the way you grieve. And as terrible as this sounds, whether you feel a degree of responsibility. And I ask this from a place of having loved ones deal with mental health and feeling that level of responsibility. And of course, those family members of mine haven't gotten to the point that your mom did. But I guess I'm curious to know if, as you discovered these things from her past, if there was a sense of, I wish I knew this so I could have helped, or how they factored into how you were grieving.
I think in many ways, I knew a lot of the things that had happened to her. They had been revealed in bits and pieces. The whole story was always hard to put together, but I knew she had gone through some really serious stuff. And I guess one thing that you undoubtedly experience when someone commits suicide is you always ask yourself, what could I have done? And a lot of people, including myself in many ways, you feel guilt or you feel like you could have done something. And the reality is, at least where I converge on this, is as much as I felt, man, if I hadn't spent that year, the year that she committed suicide, like traveling around the world, being selfish and hedonic and enjoying my life, if I had spent more time in person with her, maybe her story would have changed. Or if I had done this or that, or whatever, as you mentioned, like you find out little pieces and it's like, could I have done something about that? And I think in the end, that type of thinking, as much as like it's very natural, is not very helpful. And I tried to squash that within myself very early. And one coach I worked with actually really helped me with this. And then he said, what you're feeling is it's not guilt, it's disappointment about what could have been. This is the hard stuff, at least for me. Some of it hasn't happened, but it's disappointment that your mom doesn't get to see your future son or daughter. It's disappointment that your mom doesn't get to see you get married. It's disappointment that you didn't get to share more memories together. That's actually what you're really feeling. I actually do believe there's things I could have done to potentially prolong her life. But I think that I'm grateful that she didn't commit suicide 5 years before. And I also know that it's possible it could have come 5 years later. But at least in her story, it was, in my mind, almost like the path that she was moving towards. And I would have been lucky if she didn't end up in that outcome. And I was lucky that she didn't much sooner in my life.
I think that's a great way to think about it. And I think the advice from your friend or your coach also sounds like it was really helpful in reframing some of those feelings. I'm curious to know, as someone who has gone through several deaths, if there are ways that people around you have really helped you. And the reason that I'm asking this question is because not only will we encounter death throughout our lives, but of course we will be close to people who encounter those deaths as well. And I've never quite known, as someone who hasn't encountered this death on my own, how to support people. I don't quite know how to toe the line between, do they need advice? Do they just want a shoulder to cry on? Do they want me to check on them? And I think, of course, there's not a correct answer there, but I'm curious to know, from your perspective, how people around you were able to really support you in that grieving process.
So the idea of what other people can do to help is kind of tricky. Let me just speak a little bit to what worked and didn't work for me, and then maybe I can generalize. But shortly after my mom passed, we actually delayed the funeral and I went to New York. And I went to New York because I have a lot of friends there and I felt like I could have support. And I also could potentially have a little bit of fun, despite how hard that felt to do at the moment, to just remove myself from the heaviness of the situation. Because at least for me, I was sleeping in the bed that my mom committed suicide in. So that alone was like, I was not having a great time at night sitting there ruminating through those thoughts. So I end up in New York and I'm talking to a lot of friends and people are like, how are you? And some of these people know what happened. Some of them don't. And the people who didn't, I would be like, you know, I'm doing okay, but my mom recently died. Now that puts someone in an uncomfortable position, right? Because they don't know how to respond to that. Maybe it's even someone I didn't know that well, but it was important enough that it needed to be stated that I couldn't just pretend that life was all jolly. I think in that moment, I've invited someone to comment on that. I think what I personally needed was I didn't need someone to be like, I'm so sorry, you know, what happened? I didn't really want to rehash the details. What I personally found most helpful were people who I knew they were there for me if I needed them, and I would get to set the terms of how they were there for me. I didn't need someone prodding me, asking about the decision of removing her from life support or any of that. But I did need like a network of people who I knew I could call if I needed to. And I felt like I actually had that and that they weren't bothering me, because I think what a lot of people do is they project their own discomfort about a situation or almost selfish desire to know something and don't really think, oh, you're going to force someone to rehash something. So I'd say the best thing that I think anyone can do for a friend is just say, I'm here for you if you need anything. I genuinely mean that. Use me as a resource in whatever way that you feel like you need. I'm not going to check in with you all the time unless that's something that you want. Just please let me know. I just want to help you in whatever way I can. And if that means being silent or just being here whenever you need me, just know that you can call me anytime. I personally found that most helpful. There's a fine line there because you also don't want to say, let me know how I can help, because then that puts it on me to come up with some way in which you can help me. And that's increasing the burden.
Just as a follow-up question there, is it helpful for people to follow up every so often? So certainly not frequently, but let's say every 6 months or so, just to check in to see how you're doing. And the reason I ask this is because a close friend of mine lost her mom a couple years ago. And I've also heard Sheryl Sandberg talk about this in a similar way, where they basically say that people feel uncomfortable sometimes bringing up the death or checking in on their friends because they feel like they're going to remind them of the death. And their response is, look, you don't have to remind me of this. Like, I think about this person every day or at least very often. And so it's not a trigger, but it is nice to feel like people are there for me. So does that also resonate with you, or do you prefer just to know that someone is there when you need to reach out?
So I think the distinction that's generalizable is that I personally wouldn't check in with someone just in the context of that event. Instead, I would do something like, hey man, you want to catch up? And I would get on the phone and we'd have a conversation. And maybe as one piece of that, I'd be like, how are you doing? And it's not the whole point of us checking in. It's not forcing that moment, because as you mentioned, I know what happened. And I also wasn't uncomfortable talking about it, because how could I not talk about it? It was such an important event in my life. But at the same time, I think the most uncomfortable thing is dealing with other people's discomfort. Just as like a side analogy here, because I didn't grow up as a dad, I, for whatever reason, I thought it was a funny joke, especially around wealthy people who have two parents and a stable life. I'm like, must be nice to have a dad. And that joke often doesn't go over well. And I think I understand now why, but I could do that because I was comfortable not having a dad. It was like, of course, that's my reality. And I think for the other person, it's like a little bit of an odd joke. And it's mostly representative of my odd sense of humor. And I think acceptance of the things that are happening to me. I'm not trying to run away from this thing, but I also don't want to have to deal with whatever baggage you're bringing to the situation. The other thing is, you don't want to like faux empathize unless you're giving some really helpful advice. If someone asked you for advice, like if I said, I'm going through this, I knew that you lost your grandma, was there anything helpful? I don't want you to give that advice probably unless it's prompted by me. So I would say pay attention to the other person. And to be honest, I think just being attuned with what people need, what I need is certainly different than someone else. Someone else might want you to check in all the time, but I think a lot of people go wrong because they're just projecting their own discomfort on the other person. Just a few other quick ones that come to mind. One was when I was in New York with all my friends, as silly and as simple as this sounds, one of the things I remember is that nearly every meal that I went to, my friend paid for. They kind of did it under the guise of, oh, you're in New York visiting me, I'm going to pay for this meal, like something that was expected. But it happened at a rate that was so high that it certainly was a little bit more about that. And I think it was like, hey man, you just went through a tough time. I'm going to take care of you. That for me was a gesture that I appreciated at that time. And I think it speaks to the emotional attunement of some of my friends and interacting with me and such. And that was maybe a $20, $30 gesture. But at the same time, I actually found that in retrospect to be something that just alleviated the burden a little bit. It made me feel loved in its own way. The third thing is actually for the funeral, I didn't ask anyone to come, but I did have, I believe, four of my friends come. Two of them actually sidelined their trip to New Orleans. They came down to a funeral and ended up giving up their good time for what was otherwise a sad time. And it meant a lot to me that they showed up. I certainly didn't expect my friends to show up. And I didn't invite them because I didn't want to put pressure on them. And then I had two other friends who showed up. One of them rented a badass car and he lived in South Florida. And it ended up being actually my favorite Hot Wheels car from my childhood, like my dream of what was the best car. And I don't think he knew that at the time, but he's like, let me show up in style and then take Calvin away. And I ended up actually going with him for 2 weeks and living with him. And that was very helpful. Him and his girlfriend at the time, I spent time with them and his daughter. And they were just compassionate. They were there for me. They took care of things. They let me have my space. And that meant a ton to me because they showed up and they showed up in a big way. And it also helped build the friendship as well. Perhaps the last and a really simple thing, but when someone's grieving, just be a little bit more compassionate and patient with them because I think that's obvious. But I may not be lashing out at you because you did anything, even if I'm saying that's what it is. It may just be that I have this emotional volcano within. And I think just being compassionate and perhaps for longer than you'd expect is a really good thing. And then I'm going to add a fifth one as well, which is treating people like adults. This kind of gets to what you're talking about, but it's not like I don't know what happened. I know what happened and I'm trying to get through it. And I'm an adult and I'm working my way through it. I think it's just important to remember that people may be stronger than you think.
I think that relates to the concept that you brought up earlier, which is just the benefit at times in focusing on the future and not necessarily wallowing in the past. And it doesn't mean you just completely glance over what's happened, but also not sinking yourself in the past or sinking someone into that sadness. Because to your point, I think people can be really resilient and there's nothing wrong with going through that trauma or being really sad. But as a friend, sometimes I think it can be helpful to help your friend move towards the future and not just the sadness of what happened. As you continue to move through your grief, you've mentioned that a particular psychedelic experience almost seemed to, in a way, close that chapter. Of course, it still impacts you today, but seemed to have a very significant impact on your grieving. So why don't you share a little more about that?
Before I do, just to touch on your point about creating something for the future versus obsessing about the past, I flew to New York to be with my friends, not to rehash what happened with my mom, but to have fun memories and to remember that life had some joy in it. And so in many ways, like actually your approach would have made a lot of sense, which is I wanted to go have fun. I didn't want to sit and wallow with you. I could have done that at home. I actually came to have this good experience. The last thing I'll say, just because it came to mind before we dive into the psychedelic experience, I think if you're an employer, one thing you can do to help your employee, give them at least a month off, no questions asked. That may seem like a big ask, but I think if someone dies who is actually very close to them, I would give someone a month. I think that's like an act of compassion that would go a long way in the workplace and certainly increase my loyalty to a company. On the psychedelic experience, a few months after my mom passed, I was living in Nicaragua and I met these two guys who had gone to Burning Man and I had never been. And actually, I really had never heard of it. I guess it's just this massive party in the desert was my takeaway. Of course, it ended up being much more than that, but inspired me to go to Burning Man. I ended up convincing one of my friends, actually one of the guys who went to my mom's funeral, to come with me. And it was just a two-man's trip there. Before I went, I started doing a lot of reading about psychedelics. I had done psilocybin before, magic mushrooms in a few cases, and I found that it really opened up my eyes in a lot of ways and really helped shape some of my perspectives on the world. During this Burning Man, I wanted to try LSD for the first time. I actually had never tried it. So on one of the nights, me and my friend, who I will not name, took some LSD. And I won't bore you with all the, you know, crazy stuff of what happens on a trippy experience. But let's just say that the dose that we took, the impact that we felt, and he had done it many times before, was probably about four times what we were expecting. We went on a wild 10-hour ride through the desert of Burning Man in the night. I think what was really interesting about that journey is about 3 hours in, we laid down on the sand and I was looking up at the moon. And for whatever reason, my eyes just really gravitated towards the moon. And I at the time felt that it had a very motherly or nurturing presence. I feel like the sun is a bit rowdy, but the moon, it felt almost very motherly to me. I'm not sure if that makes sense, but take a look at the moon and tell me if you think it feels feminine. At least at that moment, it did for me. And my eyes zeroed in on a way. And at that moment, I actually transported myself into my mom's deathbed in the hospital, connected to the tubes. Looking at the moon was like her light. And that light was her leaving this world and finally having the peace that she needed. I'm sure that doesn't really make sense or wasn't as profound, but at least for me at that moment, I could like truly empathize with my mom's experience and how she felt that the only pathway for her to peace was to follow the light. And that light was her exit from the world. The second profound moment came close to the end of the experience for us, which was near the sunrise. Burning Man has this temple that they recreate every year. People go in there and they leave like pictures of people that they've lost and they leave notes with them. And at the end of Burning Man, they burn the temple down and it's supposed to be like a release of all the emotion and stuff. So me and my friend entered the temple and we were finally winding down from our experience. I sat down away from my friend and I started writing. I started writing some things about my mom and I had a picture of her that I wanted to leave in the temple and have it burn. And as I wrote those things down and sat there, I relived the whole experience, the thing that we just walked through. I heard the call in Bali. And mind you, this is on a psychedelic mind. So I like truly relived it in this kind of fascinating way. I heard my grandma's voice. I went to the ocean. I saw my mom's body. I gave her the hug. We had the experience. We removed her from life support. I watched her pass away and I held her hand as she did. I relived all of that in probably 2 minutes. And my friend came over and he gave me a hug and I just bawled my eyes out. I needed him at that moment. I needed someone to feel less alone. I felt so alone at that moment, having relived that, feeling really truly the depth of pain yet again. And he encouraged me to go up and leave the note and the picture. So I walked up and did that. And we left that temple and it was later burned down. And we went and sat on a couch and debriefed. And I told him about some of the guilt I felt, or as we've reframed, disappointment, that I felt like I was selfish up until that point in my life. I was selfish with my money, with my experiences, with everything, and how I felt like I maybe could have helped my mom in some way, and how I was just so sad that her story ended the way it did. And I think that was the first time of me expressing that out loud to someone close to me. As I left that temple, though, and that experience, and went to sleep that morning, I woke up with what I can't describe other than just like a 50-pound weight off my chest. I genuinely felt lighter. I felt like I had been carrying this, as I've called it before, like this emotional volcano, and it was weighing me down in different ways. And I was doing fine to anyone looking at me externally. In fact, a lot of people are like, how are you so okay? And I was in some ways, but I was also carrying this burden and this psychedelic experience, like this whole thing. I've tried to capture some of it. I don't think it will make sense to most people. But what I can say is at the end of it, I felt a release that I knew I had come to Burning Man for, that I was seeking. And when I left that experience, my relationship with my mom's death has ever since been so much lighter. I remember the positive things in our life. I no longer dwell on what could have been. And instead, I try to carry her legacy forward. The legacy I put forward in the eulogy that we'll link in the notes, which is her spirit of compassion, authenticity, and belief. Believing fully in people and the goodness of the world. And I think just looking at some of my family members, some of whom may be listening to this, I think in many ways, some of the things that I did to move forward, including that experience at Burning Man, really allowed me to progress through the stages of grief and not feel as anchored to this past and not feel that kind of guilt that can really weigh you down after suicide in particular. And I'm not recommending psychedelics for people going through grief, like at all. It could have been a very bad experience where I relived things in a traumatic way. But what I'll say is I prepared myself for that moment. I did my research. I went into it with the intention of having an experience like this. And I wasn't sure what that experience would be, but it was exactly the experience I needed.
I've mentioned this before, but something I've observed about you is that compared to the average person, I find that you are much more willing to lean into uncomfortable situations, whether that is crying on your friend's shoulder. I know that was a psychedelic experience, but that's something that seems to have helped you move through that trauma. Another example is cleaning out that storage, which I think most people would just leave for a long period of time. One other example of this is your willingness to share these stories. So you've published the eulogy online, you've shared the story online, now you're talking about it on this podcast. That leads me to my question, which is, what has pushed you to want to share this very personal part of your life with so many other people?
I think there are a couple of driving forces. One of them is, this is my way of taking Howard's legacy forward, of paying it forward. I feel that for some reason, I'm able to talk about experiences that other people are either unwilling to talk about or unable to talk about. And in a way where hopefully it's not about me. Like, this podcast episode is not about me. It's not about my sob story. I don't want people to feel bad for me. I don't want them to tell me how sorry they are for me or anything like that. That's not really what I'm looking for, because I do think there's a big difference between sharing and oversharing. And my hope is that I found some sort of way of sharing in a way that is helpful for other people. I think the second piece, which is selfish, is this helps me with my healing. When I articulate my words via an article, or when I share something online that's helpful to people, it's a way of me connecting with other people and also connecting with my own thoughts and processing them. This goes back to what I was talking about of being present with your grief. I think you want to be present with it. You want to listen to it, but you also want to articulate what's going on, because when you do that, you can find ways to move forward. And I certainly was not going to do LSD in the first 3 months of grieving for my mom, because I knew I was a mess. But I prepared myself for 6 months to have an experience that would hopefully let things go. It was all intentional for me. And again, it didn't happen in the way that I would have known, because how could I know? I had never taken the drug before. But I did know that, like, I needed to navigate this journey in a way that didn't leave me just like sitting sad all the time. My mom wouldn't want that. Howard wouldn't want that. And I certainly didn't want that for my life either. And the third piece, at least from my mind, is like, why not? I feel like when I've seen these things, when I've held my mom's hand as she passed away, like, that experience has allowed me to connect with people in a completely new way. Like, my ability to empathize with people very quickly and understand what they're going through, or at least help them through that, is so much greater from that one moment. Like, that changed for me completely. And I'll say that when you share like this, not only does it help you, but you hear from other people as well. You're more willing to tell me things too. And I think that's the way I like to connect with people. If you ever meet me in person, we're probably going to go much deeper into life than you would ever want. But that's all a piece of the same thing, which is, I want to get to the real stuff of life. I don't really care necessarily about some of the superficialities, which you can easily get caught up in.
I was going to save this question for the end, but it relates to what you just spoke about, which is how these deaths can change the way that you live moving forward. In one of your articles, you wrote, "I'd happily give everything I have and start over to spend one more day with my mom, but I can't make that trade. When someone dies, life moves on, and all you have are the decisions you made before they left." So I guess my question is, outside of your ability to better connect with people, how have these experiences changed you?
I think what's interesting is things change, but they also stay the same. And so the person leaves your life, but life continues to go on. Like, you have to keep going to work. You have to keep moving forward, and you're just adjusting to this new reality without these people. So one change for me, at least in how I've dealt with grief, is I feel like I'm going to experience many more deaths in my life. And so one thing I don't want to do is, I don't want those to make me really bitter about the world. I don't want to become sad by the pain and suffering that we all face. And I think that's actually one thing that can happen. Instead, my approach to it is, I'd like to do something which I think is called post-traumatic growth. You go through a difficult experience, you go through the trenches of it, and then you come out on the other side stronger or wiser in some way. I've always tried to figure out, how can I do that in these situations? One just practical thing that has changed me is my commitment to paying it forward after Howard's death is increased dramatically. And my commitment to living a pretty authentic life that is aligned with my dreams is something from my mom's life, where I don't know if I'll have tomorrow, or I don't know if I'll have tomorrow with the people that I love. So why would I sacrifice today, whether that's at a job that I'm not that happy at, or living in a place that I'm not super happy in or being in a relationship that isn't working for me, I think I'm much more willing because of these experiences to recognize that life is really short and you got to make it what you want to make it and you shouldn't wait around for that. I think I've been attuned to that since I was a young person. I've always had a deep connection to the more existential parts of life, and these experiences really solidified that for me. Another thing is just for the people in my life who I really care about, I try to make an extra effort to connect with them, whether it's a phone call to a friend or a visit to a friend. I go out of my way to make sure that I'm staying in touch with the people that I really care about. With my grandparents, for example, who are really important people in my life, I make sure to call them once per week. That's meaningful to them. It's also meaningful to me. And I know that if anything happened, I would have talked to them recently and live by my commitment of not letting too much time pass before I talk to someone I love. Practically speaking, one of my recommendations for people and one of my regrets with my mom, I don't have like videos with my mom. And that means I don't really have artifacts of her voice. Pictures are one thing, but really seeing someone's kind of person comes through their voice and other things. And I desperately wish that I had a video interviewing her about her life or just hearing her laugh at my stupid jokes or whatever. And I've done that with people I love in my life, like my grandparents. I've sat down and I've interviewed them and I have those films where I'm like, tell me about your life. What did you learn? Tell me about what I was like growing up. I do an extra thing here where I know that if they ever go, I will have this thing that I can turn back on that is really important to me. And then maybe the fourth thing is just when I see other people going through these experiences, I feel like I know how to be there for them in a way that's actually useful to them. So even if it's a stranger who's going through some shit, and it doesn't have to be death. That's another thing that I hope people take away from this. Death is one form of pain, but another is like a traumatic divorce or your company gets dissolved and you have to fire everyone. Like we all go through really hard experiences, and I try to be there present and fully for those people, but probably for anyone I interact with. I try to bring a fully present self to that conversation because, you know, who knows if we'll have another one.
One thing that I'll just add there based on our conversations is not being afraid to splurge on experiences with your loved ones. And in fact, really prioritizing that. You mentioned this earlier in the conversation, but you were planning a trip for your mom before she passed away. And unfortunately, it never ended up happening. But since then, something that you have made a reality is your grandparents had always wanted to move back near the beach where they, I think, lived for a while. And you bought them an apartment for a month so they could spend a month there. And they absolutely loved it. That was just one way of you giving them an amazing experience. And it wasn't particularly cheap, but it was something that in the grand scheme of things, I think you're very happy that you did. And I've seen you do this in other ways as well, where just in recognizing the fragility of life, you're now more willing to spend on these experiences with the people you care the most about, because those are what really matter. And those are what you're going to remember years from now.
I'm glad you added that because I think it is very related to how you began this part of the discussion, which is that piece of writing where, you know, I said, I'd give up everything I have today to get one more day with my mom. That's really true. And I know that would be hard for me as well to give up the comforts of what I have right now. But at the same time, just to have moments with the people you love, those are clearly to me the most important things of life. And I think it's easy to let time go by not seeing the people you care most about, or to not do that experience because it may be a little bit outside of your budget. But at the end, I've never regretted spending on relationships and experiences with people I care about. And even some of the best things with my mom, she had very little money. But every time I came home from college, she was like, we're going to have a new experience together. So she took me on a hot air balloon ride. She took me on like a boat ride to see gators in Florida. And one time we jointly got a place in Clearwater Beach, which was one of her favorite places, and just spent a few days by the beach. And I'm so grateful we did all of those things because we got to create memories together. And that was something she left me with as well, which is just continue to create those memories and really don't hold back.
Yeah, it's so easy to be stingy with money in the moment. But to your point, I think most people would say that they would give up everything they had to have one more day with a loved one after they passed. And so why not invest in that today while you still have them around?
One other thing that came to mind, if we're talking about grieving and how to create positive memories about a person and move forward, and also investing experiences with people. Actually, this was also suggested by the coach who told me about the disappointment versus grieving distinction, which was on the anniversary of my mom's death, which is my birthday, to get my friends together and have a positive experience. So that first year after she died, I rented an Airbnb in San Diego and invited all of my best friends to come to that house. Pretty much everyone came, and we ended up having 3 days of an amazing time. And I think for some of those people, I also bought like skydiving experiences. And I think we had mostly a good time, although I think not everyone loved the skydiving, but I was happy to do that because we created these memories. And now actually every year during New Year's, we've gone to a new location with that same group of friends. And that's become, instead of me mourning on my birthday and the death of my mom, which are just a weird coincidence of events for it to happen that way, it's actually, you know, a positive thing where I get to hang out with all my friends and they're very nice to me. Actually, they do a great job of, they don't make the experience about me or my mom's passing, but there is often like some moment where we recognize why this event was created in the first place. And we have a little moment and that's a recognition, and that's good enough for me. And it makes me feel good because everyone's having a good time and gotten together. And so a cool tradition has come out of that. And that was something I never anticipated, but that's been really helpful for me.
I think that's great that you've designed these positive experiences around something that is one of the hardest things someone can go through. Just to get the other side of this coin, what are some of the triggers that you experienced today? And I guess what moments still remain really hard for you, even though we're 3 years past the event?
I think if you've never experienced someone's death, you assume that things like the anniversary of when they died or just classic markers that would remind you of the experience would be the hardest. For me, that has not been the case necessarily. Actually, the triggers are random things, and just give you a sample of them. Like when I see a mom playing with her child, that is often for me kind of a painful experience. When I hear my friends talk about their mom, and I don't ever say, hey, don't do that around me because it's a trigger, but it's like a reminder that I don't have a mom anymore. When I think forward about having children or getting married, like we just got engaged, I can't tell my mom. Like that kind of sucks. And that's a moment where, whether it's Howard or my mom, there's all these like micro moments, those moments that represent the connection that you had with that person where you want to share with them. And I would say another thing that I'm just a big ball of sobbing about is I read a lot, and sometimes people in like memoirs will talk about the death of their mom. I think Kevin Hart's was one that comes to mind where he talked about his mom passing, who he was close with. And I'm just like crying. It's like an instinctual response as I read and think about the loss of his mom and those kind of little things that I don't think you would expect, but those are more of the triggers for me. Also, besides the New Year's celebration and stuff, like on my mom's birthday, I always take that day off of work and I go surf or I do something restorative. I get a massage. Actually, 1 year, like I surfed a wave with a dolphin and I really felt like it was my mom there. She loved dolphins. But point being, I try to create these moments of self-compassion around potential dates or other things that could be difficult for me.
As we close out the episode, I wanted to circle back to the concept of this episode, which is finding meaning in death. There's obviously no right way to handle a death, but since you have experienced your fair share, especially at a young age, I was hoping that you could share some parting words of wisdom for people listening, whether they're grieving themselves, whether they're anticipating grief, and generally just share what you've learned about finding meaning in death.
One thing that I've personally found helpful, just more generally on the topic of death and thinking about the people I've lost, but also my own mortality, there's a Steve Jobs quote that I really like, and it goes like this: remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life, because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. That quote reminds me a lot of how the Stoic philosophers view death, which is it's just one event that happens in our life. It's just like birth, and it's just like all the other things that happen to us. We're all going to experience this fate. And I think one of the things that I've tried to take away is when I start feeling myself getting concerned about the petty things in life, how many followers I have, who's annoying me right now, how I'm going to get through this set of problems that I'm facing. When I really consider that in the grand scheme that I'm going to die and so are all of the people around me, I think you can just have a better perspective on those things. You can almost remove yourself from the noise of all these emotions that are in your head and the monkey brain and say, hey, is this going to matter in 10 years? And I think my connection to that has certainly been increased by seeing people around me die. And I take this approach that by openly embracing my mortality, I and others can focus on what truly matters in life, whether that's relationships, your career, whatever you decide that matters. But the important thing is to not deny death. It's to accept it. Say, okay, great. Like life is short. It's finite. What am I going to do with it? How am I going to stop wasting my time on the things that certainly won't matter on my deathbed? At least for me, that flows into all of my decision-making. We've talked on this podcast a lot of times about career decisions. And in large part, I feel like I'm able to make jumps or do things that other people aren't willing to do because I just have this kind of connection to the brevity of it all. And in the end, I know that X decision is probably not going to determine the fate of my life. And even if it does, like I'm going to pass away and not remember it. So I want to leave with that note, which is that it's worthwhile to think about your own mortality. And I think you can use that as a way to better navigate your life and your decisions so that you're not ending up on your deathbed with regrets.
I think that's a wonderful way of closing out this episode. I can't predict this for sure, but I have a feeling that people will really enjoy this episode. It's very different to the episodes we've done in the past, but I think it'll resonate with a lot of people, whether they're grieving themselves or they just appreciate the level of emotion, the level of transparency that you shared. So if people have additional questions about dealing with death, finding meaning in it, or any of the topics that we've covered in this episode, you can send them to us. You can find me at StephSmithIO on Twitter.
And you can find me at Calvin_Russer on Twitter.
I think what might happen is we might get a lot of these and we'd be very open to doing a follow-up episode addressing those questions.
Yeah, I'd definitely be down for that. I guess I'd like to end it with a thank you to you, Steph, for walking us through all of those memories and in such a structured way. I think a lot of the questions you prepared and the conversation we had was, I hope, interesting and helpful for people and maybe has you thinking about what's important in your life. And if you're going through a hard time, maybe how you can better navigate that and to understand that other people are going through these things and there are no answers and we're all just figuring it out, which may sound trite, but I think is very true.
I really appreciate you agreeing to do this. As I've mentioned throughout the episode, I don't know many people who would agree to engage in a conversation like this and share the level of detail that you have, but I think it's a great thing. I think there's going to be a lot of people who have lost their moms, lost their mentors, lost other important people in their lives, or they may be like me who hasn't experienced that quite yet, but is almost living in anticipation of that in a fearful state. So even just being able to process this and ask questions, I think was really helpful for me. And like I said, I think it'll be really helpful for other people listening. I also think this is a really special way of being able to connect with our podcast. For the people that listen to us, we're in their ear for an hour plus, but we're typically talking about technical or left brain topics. But it's important to remember that we're people. And I hope that our listeners appreciated this alternative side of our podcast.
I'm glad we did it.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Until next time.